Welcome to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Today, Crystal Starr talks with documentary filmmakers and photojournalists Richard Eagleton and Kevin Downs about capturing the stories and lives of people all over the world for nonfiction film and print. Kevin Downs is a photojournalist based in Brooklyn, New York. His lenses capture both news stories and in-depth portraits. After graduating from Pratt Institute and City College, he worked and published his photographs in multiple countries. He's currently focusing on projects in the United States, including a long-term documentary on the Iron Triangle, an area of Corona, Queens, where he follows the path of people who immigrated and made a life there. Here's Crystal Starr talking with Kevin C. Downs.
I started out in high school in fine arts class, and I had a teacher by the name of Edgar Parrish, who was a relative of Maxfield Parrish. And so he got me interested in everything from drawing, painting, and photography. I would spend like hours of a day in high school in the darkroom learning how to print. And we were too poor to have a timer. So he just said, do 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. That's how we used to do our printing and stuff like that and developing. And then same with film. We'd have a film and develop our own film and stuff. So what got me started was seeing photographs by Eli Reed, who's a magnum photographer, Gil Perez, by Saul Leiter, who's a New York street photographer, Robert Frank, who was a friend of mine, and also Lou Stettner. They were considered street photographers, documentary photographers.
It seems to have been a real honor to be able to not only learn from these people, but to come up under them with their guidance and their experience. Photography has evolved. From your time, from the beginning of you picking up a camera, how have you seen that evolution sort of take place and play out in front of you? And how has that affected your work and your ability to work?
Film was slower, naturally, but I think film had a more depth to it. If you would take your time before you'd shoot a shot. Now with digital, you can bang out 1,000 images in a day. And another one is I also, I used to belong to a great agency in Paris called Cosmos. The woman there, Annie Boulard, was my agent and friend. She helped me get more into the way of thinking as a more of a documentary photographer, I would say. A real documentary, because I do stories, but with her I would apply these stories from film and digital, so I was able to use both. And I'm considering these things now more like a thing in a toolbox, like a tool. Film is still a tool, digital is a tool. Even using an iPhone with like three lenses is a tool in the toolbox of your camera bag. So to try and help me tell stories. I mean, it's changed to be like where everything is, you can get everything out there speedily, fast. That's good. You can get your stories out fast. But also I like the way that things used to be because it was a little slower and it gave you a chance to think about your stories.
So your profession as of now is a documentary photographer, but you've also done work as a photojournalist.
Right, yes.
Can you sort of give me the distinction between the two of those? Because you're speaking about getting the story out there, and that is part of both.
Right.
However, I think that there's a difference between the two.
Well, in photojournalism, you're telling a story, but the story you really don't revisit and revisit and revisit over and over again. Like documentary, you can keep on building. And it's a great thing.
Yeah. As a documentary photographer, it seems as if the story is elongated, and you would, when you say you revisit the story, meaning there are multiple moving parts to the story and people who you talk to and sit down with. Now, photographer and videographer are two different things, but do you do both video and still photography?
I do some video because that's part of the work of now being a photojournalist. You have to do video, but it's basically for the story that I'm working on and for one of the papers for web. But with a documentary, I can work on it and work on it and work on it. Like I'm working on a project in Texas right now that deals with poverty and migration. And then I've been working on a project for 10 years or more in Corona, Queens, in a junkyard called the Iron Triangle. And it's basically small immigrant shops. Some of them are undocumented immigrants who own businesses and they're paying taxes and they're living here and employing people. So I'm going like, this is what I'm trying to tell their story. Because in our time right now, people who are immigrants or undocumented are being sought as evil or rapists or criminals. So, and I'm trying to say no. That's, you know, you basically see that in everything. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's.
Yeah, I mean. It answers a question actually that I haven't asked, but I wanted to about, you know, as a documentarian, you are involved in these people's lives and you are documenting their lives. What are some of the challenges that you face with some of these stories, such as the one you're just speaking about with the undocumented immigrants? What are some challenges that you face, not only just as the artist, but also the barriers of culture and sharing that someone else's story about their experience?
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. I try and be a fly on the wall, and I try and get immersed into the culture. A lot of the culture I'm documenting are basically Mexican migrants who've immigrated here and set up business and started families. I have a connection with them a little bit. I just found out that 4% of my DNA is Mexican, so, which is interesting. I'm just trying to document what I'm seeing in these people who are honest and beautiful and singing and going to their parties, and not much anymore now thanks to COVID, but because we're all trying to be safe and stay alive, you know, but like one of my subjects in the Iron Triangle, her sister died of COVID and tried to help her raise money so they can bury her sister. And so you get emotional sometimes in this, you try, that's one thing difference about photojournalism, you can step away and get away. With documentary, become into their lives and you start being pulled in. Like there's a woman that I love her work. She's fantastic. She's a good friend of mine, Darcy Padilla. She's been photographing a family and one woman who just died a couple of years ago who have been on drugs for the past 20 years. She's been following this one woman and the woman passed away. Now she's following the husband and kids. She's just a fantastic photographer. She's now teaching. If anybody's out there, she teaches in San Francisco and she also teaches at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. So, and if you have her around, study with her. So.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, in order to really capture the true sentiment of a person and a culture and a community, you do get drawn in. That makes me want to ask the question about, you know, it goes without saying that there's so much going on in the world, but even more presently right here in our country, there is an election, civil unrest in the streets. Are you documenting, because these are real life situations that people are experiencing.
I'm documenting, I didn't do much of what's happened in New York. I didn't do much of a lot of the COVID, early days of COVID with bodies being poured in and out of the hospitals and stuff like that, because I'm always looking for the deeper stories and things like this, and like in what's going on in the United States with troubles and racial strife and politics and poverty. I was trying to find the deeper story in there that can make it last beyond the time that it's taken, and to make people think. You know, that's my, I like having people think. And it's like a friend of mine, I was talking to him, his name is Zia Gifik, he's from Bosnia, he's with Seven. Really great guy. And we were talking once and he was saying, Kevin, you know, I don't understand why a lot of American photographers are traveling and documenting war and stuff overseas when you have it all here. You know, you have poverty, you have racial, you know, divisions, you have things almost breaking out into war, violence, poverty again. So it's like, and I'm going like, wow, you're right. You know, and I hope documentary photographers, and I hope we can tell stories that'll wake people up just with a camera, you know, just a, you know, as I tell people, just a little thing like this with film or digital, you know, it's like a little camera, you know, people are afraid of it and they kill you for taking a photo. So
why do you think that is? Why do you think people are so against being photographed when that is sort of the times that we live in? Why does that violence, or, you know, you said you could get killed for taking a photo of someone. Yeah, why do you think that is when that is a part of our culture now?
I don't know. It's like going back to like the 40s, the 50s, even back further. And I'm just thinking about this, and like, I'll give an example. Like, I was in Alabama photographing one of my friends who's passed away is William Christenberry, who's been photographing architecture in Hale County, Alabama, and Greensboro. And Walker Evans is even photographed down there with James Agee. And I was down there by myself driving through Uniontown, Alabama, which is outside of Montgomery. And I found William Christenberry's photograph, our building that he photographed, called The Club. But it wasn't the same club that he did. It's the same building, but the club that he did was spelled K-L-U-B. And it was painted black and white with a, like a hood. So it was William Christenberry said it was a Klan's club, a Klan club. And I found that it's more like a strip club now. And I'm photographing it. The town is almost dead. Next thing I know, a guy drives up and a coat was sitting next to him. Next thing I know, a shotgun came out from underneath the coat and told me, you have to move, get out of town. I said, I'm just photographing some buildings. Go photograph a building somewhere else.
Do you think that's because he didn't want you exposing some sort of truth about the building or the community? Or
I think he was probably a member of the old Klan that's there and still doesn't like people photographing or doing things.
That was Kevin C. Downs talking with Crystal Starr. More from Downs when we come back. Stay with us.
Tristesse, you've been knocking, you've been pounding. send me to the war. Where your body is the cell that keeps me fleeing you, keeps me fleeing you. And your sirens are the key that keep me needing you, keep me needing you. Long goes off, the world is dark, and breathing in, I breathe you in. Your perfume and your golden ring. And leaning down, you say to me, just please, please don't forget that it's you. You've been calling for so long, singing in the mornings, even helped me write this song. And oh now, Lady Tristesse, you've been knocking, you've been pounding at my door. I open and you leave me bleeding on the floor. My lover, my killer, my hunter, my queen. I crowned you, then I throned you, then you sent me to.
Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. Crystal Starr continues her conversation with Kevin Downs, a photojournalist based in Brooklyn, New York. Currently, he is working on projects documenting life in the United States, covering issues such as people affected by the economy and immigration. He shares with us his future plans and discusses the importance of who tells the stories.
My dream is to go back to the small town in Falfurrias, Texas. I love that little town. I fall in love with little towns like Greensboro and Falfurrias. They're like maybe an hour and a half away from McAllen, Texas, which is the border. And that's what I would love to do, is go down there and help kids who want to study or want to learn the craft of documentary photography, even if they don't want to take it up as a full-time, but they can document their family or their experience. I think the more people who are doing it, the more stories that come out, I think the more this country will change, put it like that. And I'd like to get it into the hands of kids who come from rich backgrounds, but from working class or poor backgrounds, so, which is where I come from. It doesn't matter if you're white, African-American, Hispanic, Asian-American, whatever. Just that, you know, the poor communities need their voice. They don't need somebody coming in from a wealthy community to be their voice.
Right. Do you see that play out in documentary? You know, you were speaking about having issues with people from wealthier backgrounds trying to convey the impoverished story or stories about hardship.
Right. Like me, I'm photographing a minister in Camden, New Jersey, by the name of Levi Combs and his wife. They are own the oldest African-American funeral home in Camden. And I love them. They're like really great people, and I love photographing them. The thing that makes it interesting is their story. And their story is not my story, like a white American guy. Their story is African-American. And I went to a friend of mine, Wendell White, who teaches documentary photography at a college in Atlantic City. He's an African-American photographer. And he's guiding me to help me in to try and tell a real story about the African American experience, even though I'm not African American. So,
so that's, that sounds like it's kind of like, what are the right questions to ask? What are, you know, where do you assert yourself, and where do you sort of allow for? And I'm sure that that is true for any story that you're telling, where you, there is a point where you can assert yourself, but there's also a point where you need to stand back and sort of allow it to unfold.
Right. And that's what I try to do. And like, they were telling me the difference between an African-American funeral, a white funeral, a Hispanic funeral, and why COVID was attacking their community hardest in Camden. How they were telling me how people were angry during the height of COVID in Camden, that they couldn't go in and be with their loved ones at the funeral home because they would get COVID and die because the body's still shedding virus. He said some people would be angry and almost wanted to attack him and beat him up. And, you know, he said, this is the difference in our community, is that people are, families are tight. And I love, and I love this part of finding out a new culture, a new, and, you know, I don't, also I try not to see things as racial because, you know, there's only one race, there's a human race. So, and I see it more as an ethnic thing. So, an ethnic part of us. So like, you know, we all come from the same place. And just as time went on, we all changed a little bit. And
yeah, the evolution of the human race, right?
Right, the human race.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely.
I just wish people would start thinking about that, because I think if people, like I watched this thing on the DNA once, and this woman said, you know, she said she's French, and she said the DNA showed she had more of other people inside of her. And she said, if you found all that out, then there's no way you can be pissed off at anybody, because that's your relative over there, and that's your relative over there. So then that means we're all connected. And that's what I want to try and do in my photography, is show we're all connected. So,
yeah. That's great. That's a perfect way to end our conversation. Thank you.
That was Kevin Downs talking with Crystal Starr. Most recently, Kevin shares a series of photographs he took on November 7th, Election Day in Brooklyn. See those photos at kevincdownsphoto.com. Next, we hear from Richard Eagleton. Eagleton was born in Beirut in 1953. His family moved to the Kirkuk region of Kurdistan, a pivotal spot in Kurdish 20th century history, where his earliest cultural, sensory, and social impressions were formed. In the mid-1990s, he returned his attention to Kurdish affairs. Here's Richard Eagleton talking with Crystal Starr.
I would say I'm a friend of the Kurds, an inherited position via my father, who was a friend of the Kurds. He was an ambassador, but I am no such thing. But I am involved. I did open a news broadcast channel a few years ago in Washington, and have been loosely involved with music and documentary making for many years.
So you were speaking about the Kurds. You've spent a lot of your childhood in the Middle East, but you've also spent a portion of your adulthood in the Middle East. Can you talk to us about Dream of Freedom, the documentary that you created, and how that came about, and the status of that documentary right now?
Yes, well, loosely speaking, we can say that post 9/11, my first meeting with my father was in Spain, where I had just completed a festival of sacred music, the patron of which was the Dalai Lama. And within that festival, we had seven Kurdish musicians. But my father brought up during our dining together that he would be going to Iraqi Kurdistan the following spring. And I immediately showed a great interest and said I would like to join him. His response was, "And what are you going to do?" And I said, "Make a documentary about the Kurds," which readily fit the pattern of the time when the U.S. government was, interested in making sure that their side of what was to occur would come about. So anyway, he was able to fit me in as a companion of his tour there. And the reason he had been called in, by then he was already a retired U.S. ambassador, was because he had been working in Kurdistan in the early 1950s and had a great knowledge of the people there. So that's how my involvement at this particular time came about.
And so when you went over with your father as a companion, he was a retired ambassador, but you were going over to make a documentary. Did you make that documentary?
It did take a little while because on that first trip in early 2002, I felt a lack of knowledge. When we arrived in Kurdistan, coming in across the Tigris River from Syria, we were, so to speak, spies on Saddam's Iraq, arriving in a small outboard motorboat, and immediately were taken on a tour to meet with all the different Kurdish leaders, the most, starting with the most important, the Barzanis. And so for the next 3 weeks or a month, I was around all these people and got to know quite a bit about them and filmed continuously. However, that ended with me still feeling dissatisfied over what I understood of the whole situation. And subsequently, I went back in again to Baghdad in 2003, soon after this, what was called the liberation at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And continued. It was not until probably mid-2004 and a third period of being in Iraq and Iraqi Kurdistan that I was able to complete Dream of Freedom, which was predominantly about the Kurds, but of course involves the whole nation and all the leadership and everything that was going on to that point.
Can you give us a little history about who the Kurds are and their relationship to their neighbors in the Middle East?
Well, the Kurds are probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest, families of peoples identified with the Medes, the Old Testament, and sometimes referred to as an ancient Iranian or Persian people. And one of my good friends in Washington refers to them as the Native Americans of the Middle East, or rather, the ones who were there and displaced and mistreated, which is why she used that term. So there's a long history involving the Kurds, but they became mountain people and divided across a number of nations, predominantly four main countries of the Middle East: Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And when you group it together, you can see, loosely speaking, Kurdistan in the middle of all that, and its mountainous regions, tribal regions, which is again like the Native Americans, with their interests and difficulties between themselves, let alone outside influence. But they became the subject of genocide in the 20th century and have been for a very long time seeking to be recognized as a people and a culture of their own. They are not Arab. They are distinct. Their language is very old and their culture is very old and developed.
Roughly, our relationship with the Kurds started after World War I, for the most part, right? Where it became a more of an official relationship. Where does that relationship stand now? What is our relationship now with the Kurds?
The Kurds are more or less one of the best allies the USA has in the world, not just the Middle East. Most loyal. They were openly saying, those of influence, that they wished to be a state of the USA post-Saddam. And many of them still feel that affinity with the U.S., despite the fact that U.S. policy keeps altering toward them, because the U.S. is balancing all kinds of interests. And behind the scenes, they are key allies, as was shown in the struggles with ISIS, where Kurdish fighters were on the ground and U.S. and allied U.S. support was backing them up with airstrikes and other intelligence and special forces on the ground.
Mm-hmm. So your documentary, Dream of Freedom, you had the opportunity to go in and sort of immerse yourself with the Kurdish people and their culture and with the military, I assume. Can you talk to us a little bit about the layers and the textures of this documentary?
Right. Well, the
and your time that you spent with them. I mean, I know you capture so much with the camera, but it also has a natural effect on you as a human being. And, you know, that's a whole different conversation, but you can add pieces of that in there if you'd like.
Okay. Well, sure enough, the involvement with the Kurds from the very beginning, you feel very welcomed, particularly as an American, and particularly as the son of someone they consider a supporter and friend. So I was welcomed into any and every household, from the powerful down to village and poor people on the street, and have that relationship continues to this day. It's almost 20 years now that I'm there every year and have immersed myself deeper and deeper into their culture, which I first had contact with as a baby, living in Kirkuk, one of the great oil fields, the second biggest in Iraq, under the control of the Baghdad government for the most part. But this is a telling factor in the whole Kurdish story, because being on top of all that wealth has been at times considered a curse. And of course, most people would say, well, what an advantage. So a lot of decisions politically have been over the economic values. And the Kurds have been a junior player there, but they have shown themselves quick to evolve. And my documentary tried to cover in the most honest, simple way how these things were emerging in 2002, 3, and 4. So this documentary, Dream of Freedom, was supposed to outline a little more of the relationships possible. However, because of the complexity and the program's some 57 minutes long, it lacks the depth that could have been there with the perhaps 150 hours of material I have. In that documentary, you hardly see any mention of the Barzanis, the most powerful Kurds at this time, even though I knew it at that time. I was working with an editor and a filmmaker who had his suggestions of what we include and what we leave out, and we didn't consider some things as important as others. However, on reviewing the material, a lot of changes would be made, and I would like to see a series come about in which the other material and all the archives that the Kurds have that I have access to, which are enormous. There are many greater tales to tell.
That was Richard Eagleton talking with Crystal Starr. When we come back, more from Richard about his documentary, Dream of Freedom. Stay with us.
I'll be gone and I'll live, or I'll stay.
Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Crystal Starr is talking with Richard Eagleton, a filmmaker who, over the last 20 years, has been working with Kurdish people. He tells us about Dream of Freedom, a documentary made in the early 2000s that he will turn into a series to achieve a fuller portrait of this unique civilization.
This documentary, Dream of Freedom, was never mass-produced, so to speak. You completed it, edited, mastered, but you just hold it. It's basically just kind of sitting on the shelf right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, because by the time the editing of that first draft had been completed, the U.S. was in the middle of trying to deal with Fallujah, which was a big bad moment with a lot of difficulties. And I felt that the documentary was out of sync with the events happening week by week. My documentary was a bit more personal and home style than the weekly news events. And so, although I showed it to a few people in London and they thought it was interesting, they were all the time seeing the daily reports on TV, and I felt it was sort of irrelevant and left it, didn't even try to market it. So my documentary, Dream of Freedom, was left on the shelf. But when I pulled it out recently and looked at it, I thought, wow, it's actually stands up now better than it did at the time, as many things do, like wine.
I was going to say, it's kind of like a nice wine at this point, huh?
Yeah, and there are some very good points in it, but as I say, I have a lot of other material that goes in depth into culture, history, and events that has never even been assembled. But I do have plans.
I was going to say, do you have plans to expand on Dream of Freedom?
Yes, indeed. It's like a lifetime commitment for me, having spent so much time and felt so welcome, like family. Not necessarily by every different group amongst the Kurds because of competing interests, but in general, my relationship is like family with them. And so I feel an obligation and commitment to tell many stories that could never be told in one feature film. There is the subject of a feature film to start out what I and others see as a series that becomes worldwide of insignificance. But that event, the first event, funnily enough, was covered by my father's first book about the Kurdish Republic of 1946, which had started in 45, end of the Second World War, and as he said in his book, was the first battle of the Cold War, because it was really about the competing interests of the Soviet Union with the U.S. and England over petroleum in Iran. And the Kurds were piggy in the middle, caught in the middle, with a small power being backed up by Soviet ideology, but not truly backed up, used as a pawn in a bigger game.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, the series would focus on the Kurds, open out from there to encompass the whole of the Middle East, which in itself is already a large and complex series, but intricate and very interesting, and would then ripple out to touch on all the empires who took an interest in the Middle East and why,
mm-hmm.
and come squarely right back to Washington and the promises made, the promises not kept, the evolution bringing us right to today. There is a very, very good line of storytelling since 1945, as the immediate bunch of seasons for a series. Anything less than a series does injustice to the subject. This series can become a very serious tool, not just of entertainment and different people's histories that are always about the winners telling their story.
Right.
Today, we can tell real stories about the different reasons for things happening from the points of view of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important and educational. And especially now with COVID being a big player on the planet, people can sit at home as they do anyway, watching the programs they like. This kind of programming is really useful in overcoming racial problems and other problems due to lack of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time is highly dramatic and interesting and will hold the attention of people. It's, you know, the basis of it psychologically would be the usual tale of love and hate that you can put into one relationship, like Romeo and Juliet, of which there are versions in the Middle East that were pre-Shakespeare, but also tell the stories in a new way that are much greater than one relationship. So you need the documentary history along with inner stories, and you can only get those inner stories if you really integrate with the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. has some people representation who are good at that, but lacks the ability that they should be able to show these days, as do all countries politically. So you have to have people who integrate with all these societies. And this series eventually ripples out to become looking at oneself in the USA.
Yeah, I really look forward to seeing seeing this sort of re-release, but also a more in-depth tale and story about United States and the Kurdish people and our involvement in the Middle East.
Well, of course, as I was saying before, the Kurds are part of our biblical history.
Mm-hmm.
Old Testament, Garden mm-hmm. of Eden. There are even claims that the Garden of Eden was in Iraq there. But anyway, that's another point. The relations side, the way I see it, we have reached the point in history where the people are ready for a reassessment of a retelling of histories,
mm-hmm.
not from the point of view of who the winners were, who are marketing their products, but in terms of real information, which means balanced views and complex views. But you can break them down into clear stories that series can tell. Now that we've reached the point where a lot of the world audience really, really grab onto series to watch,
mm-hmm.
maybe for entertainment, but it's quite clear also for good information.
Mm-hmm.
We are now ready for the reassessment where the Kurds can be a focal point as this ancient people intimately connected to us, and which brings us right up to date with the complex histories told clearly and allowing us to get better educated as well as entertained. This can be a very important tool, and it's only now that the world audience is truly ready for it, and the governments know that and cannot and do not interfere anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They will actually support it.
Yeah, our relationship with each other as humans, you know, no matter where we exist on this planet, we all exist on this planet together. And yeah, I think I would have to, I know I have to agree with you that I believe people everywhere are ready to have a retelling of our history as human beings on this planet. And like you said, not just from the mouths of the winners, but from the perspective of those of who it affected, the perspective of those families, and the way cultures have been shaped and reshaped from our interactions with each other and our interests with each other.
This goes deep because the enemy is within, as mm-hmm. shown in a pandemic of this kind.
Mm-hmm.
And the social distancing and the things we do to try and deal with it demonstrate the difficulties we have and how great fear is. Some people try to do down the fear, Trump being one of the people who found that expeditious politically, whatever his personal reasoning is.
Mm-hmm.
But fear really makes people withdraw, so that if somebody close to you tests positive and gets COVID, you find that it affects your whole circle. And that's the same with historical factors. What happened to the Kurds eventually affects the USA. We can come into world history perhaps anywhere and come to that conclusion. However, this tale has not been told and is available now to be told in such a way that everybody learns from it and is entertained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's really important because, you know, you don't have to necessarily agree with one side or the other, but to get those facts and to be able to have an opportunity to gain a perspective or an opinion about the facts is critical, I believe.
Yeah, you can then be sympathetic mm-hmm. to the bad guy or the good guy because they reverse in their roles mm-hmm. depending on time and situation. This is borne out in a lot of modern scripts
mm-hmm.
from Game of Thrones to God knows what.
Mm-hmm.
But it's become very popular mm-hmm. to show the Joker as the bad guy and the good guy within. It's all psychology, of course, of program making.
Yes.
When you're doing a series of this kind, you don't even really have to study the psychology. It's inherent
right.
in the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
But it does need to be done. It needs to be done to a very high standard. And
and you're going to do it.
Enormous. I'm very, very committed to it.
Yeah.
Along with the co-producers. And we hope we can bring it to the world audience as fast as possible.
Yeah, I think it's very important.
As fast as any other vaccine.
Yeah. Oh, that's a very clever way of looking at it.
It's healing.
It is.
If you learn properly about why people do things, what for, what their interests are, what their motivations, and the psychology behind it, you learn to want everybody to get the right healing.
Mm-hmm. That is a perfect way also to end the conversation. That's good. Well, thank you so much, Richard. Yeah, thank you, Richard, for taking the time out of your day to sit down and talk with me and share sort of your plans for the future, but also this great little history lesson on the United States and their relationship in the Middle East, but in particular to the Kurdish people.
There is so much to learn.
That was Richard Eagleton talking with Crystal Starr. TCA Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, The Burns Group, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetausradio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The first songs we heard earlier in the show are from Jack Boaz and Eli Zito. The musicians have roots in New Mexico and have multiple folk inspirations. Following them came a tune from Over Under, an art collective with folk, rock, and jazzy melodies. Here's another song of theirs, Dripping in Black. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great day.
But all my lies are dripping in black. Click, clack, creeping up the spine in my back. A cold-blooded killer, my heroin. My veins are bubbling to let you in. But all my lies are, you know, I don't care. If I got you, it don't matter where. The office depot, Times Square. Wherever she is, you can find me there. And if you're coming, don't be late. I got dinner hearts round 7:45.
shivering, trembling, cold and tired. Give me a sec, I'll build us a fire. Well, all my lies, you know.